This is the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. What a pleasure it is to be with James Mann, Bill Russell, I, Paula. Bill?
Well, you were talking about what to me is a very salient and really is necessary knowledge to understand what's happened to us literally in the last 40 years.
Yes.
Your point, I think, as you say, about writing The Rise of the Vulcans was that the tendency has been to treat 1989 as a definitive watershed.
Right.
There was pre-89 and there was post-89.
Mm-hmm.
And that there was an absolute split because the Soviet Union had collapsed, the Iron Curtain went away, and we lived happily ever after in the peace dividend, except, of course, none of that happened, which is what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that kind of discontinuity is at the very least a naive reading of how the world actually works. But what you're talking about seems to be central to where we are today.
Exactly.
Well, this is where the...
And where we might go from here.
This is where ideas come in. Ideas and rationalizations. Because let's take this. So the Cold War ends. It's important to know whether it ended because the United States forced the Soviet Union to collapse, or whether the Soviet Union and Gorbachev actually decided to abandon the field. But the Cold War ends, and you get this debate, should we cut the American military budget? And here, Dick Cheney, former Vice President Dick Cheney, plays a leading role, actually with and alongside Colin Powell and a couple of others. In the early 90s, you get a series of rationalizations why we can't cut the military
budget. As Defense Secretary.
Yeah.
Cheney is
now, in this period, early 90s, Defense Secretary. First, they decide that the Soviet Union might be really dangerous, not because it was powerful, but because it was weak. So, you know, weakness might lead to some kind of military incident.
Which had been the reverse of what they
had
said.
This is the opposite. They've been saying the Soviet Union was, in fact, stronger than it turned out to be. Then they decided it was weaker than it turned out to be.
But we still need a lot of money.
But it was dangerous, and therefore we needed a defense budget. Then that didn't work because the Soviet Union.
Budget.
Yeah. Then the Soviet Union collapses, and there's kind of a what do we come up with for a rationalization? And then they came up with, in about 92, this new rationalization that we needed an American military to preempt any new emerging power in Europe or Asia. By that, they really meant Japan or Germany. It's hard for us to even think now, but in the early 90s, there was this fear that either Japan or a reunified Germany would be a rival to the United States. Okay, then people said, well, that doesn't quite work because, among other things, Japan and Germany are our close allies. So they kind of went back to the drawing board.
And it looks bad, accusing them.
Right.
Well, and they noticed that it had gotten leaked that this was the idea that was brewing, and the allies were not happy about it.
Precisely. So then they came up with a new formulation, and this one was important. It was, we need an American military for any future rival, and in fact, we need a huge military, a military that's so big that any emerging rival would realize that it's crazy to try and challenge American military power. So that, you know, if you were some unnamed leader, you would take a look at the American military and realize that it wouldn't, you know, even if you spent 50 years on a military program, you couldn't compete with the United States.
And yet they miss the one thing, because as you say so clearly, they're always looking backward.
Right.
They miss what has happened in the world itself completely. Don't even mention
China.
Or the terrorists.
Yeah. Oh, they completely missed the terrorists.
And only Wolfowitz at the time was paying attention to the Middle East.
Right.
Hung up.
Well, because they're... So now I'm going to move ahead from 92 to 2001.
But the Clinton administration is a continuation of this think.
The Clinton administration, they are a continuation. They are a continuation almost by default. Because when Bill Clinton comes in, he is so afraid of being criticized as a dove. He hasn't served in the military. He gets into a fight about don't ask, don't tell within, you know, I think it's before he takes office even.
And he isn't really a dove.
And Yeah, and he's not. That's right. And so one way he doesn't espouse this doctrine of Cheney's so much, although people think this phrase is from Madeleine Albright, but Clinton first called the United States the indispensable nation. Madeleine Albright picked it up. So you get a different, milder version of the idea that the United States is the dominant world power, has been, always will be, can't be done without.
And should be.
Right.
There is a should to this mm-hmm. that drives yes. much of both domestic and foreign policy.
The end result of this is a foreign policy predicated on the military.
Right.
Dominated
by. And with a comparable diminution in emphasis on everything else. What Clinton did do, for better or worse, was he didn't do anything about the military piece. He added the economic piece.
Right.
To
our perspective on foreign relations.
Say right. some more about that, because it, well, actually, I'm going to quote your book, which is why I know most of these things. You say that that it's as if the Democrats and Republicans are singing the same song, that the Republicans are singing the bass line with the military,
right.
and the Democrats are singing the treble with the economy. What a great way to phrase
right.
it. And it's all the same song, isn't it?
The song is American dominance in the world.
Triumphalism.
Yeah.
I mean, we're to the
yeah.
triumphal period.
For
the Clinton administration, there's a de-emphasis in public on military power, although, you know, goodness knows, Clinton, we tend to forget. But what was then called the diplomacy of the cruise missile, Clinton was not averse to exercising American military power. But the emphasis is on its free trade, but also the sheer power of free markets. That's really the Clinton's treble note to the military being the bass note. Then you get to move after Bill Clinton, you get the George W. Bush administration coming, really re-embracing this Cheney doctrine that the United States, really emphasizing military power again.
Not only embracing it, exercising
yeah.
it. I mean, that's
yes.
essentially, by your description, I mean, it's a straight line
right.
from that perspective to essentially preemptive wars, Iraq right. being the most obvious example.
I go back to my young friend who thinks about political theory. It's easy to forget how important the United States Constitution is when
well,
you talk about.
I hope not.
Well, it's time to think again. When you talk about the importance as the George W. Bush group comes into power, seizes power, if you want to talk about it in terms of one vote in the Supreme Court, and then acting as if they have some sort of a mandate. You're also looking at people who for 30 years have been the same people, just kind of, this isn't musical chairs, it just looks like it.
Yeah.
It's what by the time that the Bush-Cheney administration comes in, these people have all been, it's the class reunion of which you speak.
Yeah.
They've all been doing this stuff, thinking this way for 30 years. And I hadn't thought about Colin Powell as being the reason that the Defense Department and the State Department sort of neutralize each other, and you've got Bush-Cheney, who now think they can do anything they want to.
Right.
Wow.
In fact, you know, by my interpretation, one of the reasons that the Bush administration was set up the way it was, you had Colin Powell at the State Department, Dick Cheney at the Defense Department. I'm sorry, Don Rumsfeld at the Defense Department.
They used to work closely
together. Cheney and Powell used to work together, but it's carefully balanced because Rumsfeld has Paul Wolfowitz underneath him. Colin Powell has his own longtime friend Richard Armitage beneath him. They're almost destined to clash. And they do, of course. And when they have a clash, this is in the first couple years of the Bush administration, who's going to settle that? It's got to be settled by the White House. And who's at the White House? You got a president who, in those first couple years, really certainly doesn't know anything about foreign policy, and knows he doesn't know anything about foreign policy. You've got a national security advisor, Condoleezza Rice, who's, you know, by general standards at the time, young in her job, really doesn't have the clout of Cheney, Rumsfeld, or Powell. So who's going to settle these disputes? Really, the person there is Dick Cheney, the guy who really knows the bureaucracy.
Who wrote the policy.
Right.
Essentially, it was published under his name.
And who consistently said, you don't understand, I am very conservative. And your distinction between the realists, the Nixonites, Nixon-Kissingers, and the conservatives who are ideologues is a very important distinction. And when you get to the last person standing is Cheney, who says, I am very conservative, and the way that you define conservative is so important, it has radical consequences.
Yeah.
That harken right back to Ronald Reagan.
That's right.
Don't they?
Cheney, it was in the period in the 80s. Well, let me go back for a second to the 70s, because Reagan first challenges President Ford for the Republican nomination. And that he's challenging him from the right as a conservative. That produces a split in the Republican Party. Cheney happens to be working, he's a very young guy. He's in his early 30s. He's an aide to Don Rumsfeld. He's working in the White House. So that split is really the Reagan conservatives against the Ford administration. And during that time in the mid-70s, Cheney is with the Ford team, which is then called the moderates. In some ways, they're not so moderate, but he's not on the Reagan team. He's not perceived as a conservative. He goes off and he runs for Congress. And a lot of people in the press keep writing about Cheney as a moderate because he'd served in the Ford administration. Cheney, I mean, he's got a conservative base in Wyoming anyway, but he knows himself. And finally, you know, he goes out, he's a congressman from Wyoming, he goes out and he tells his press secretary, will you call the Washington Post and tell them I am not a moderate, I am a conservative?
That would be Dick Cheney. Come back in a moment with us with James Mann, Bill Russell, I, Paula Gordon, Ronald Reagan, Dick Cheney, George W. and George H.W. Bush, America in the last 40 years and in the world. Be with us. We'll return shortly.